I mean, both my parents were people who, I think it's the greatest gift you give your children is that they, their expectation of us was that we would work hard, that we would, have reasonable values, would be a good citizen, would contribute to society. And then how we decided to do that or how we wanted to do it was up to us. And I think that was a huge gift because there was never any pressure that you had to be a doctor, you had to be a lawyer, you had to be whatever it was. And so for us, we had all the options in front of us. And with the foundation, you know, there aren't really too many people. I don't think I could do this. There aren't too many people who can give you, you know, several billion dollars and then just let you go out and do what you're going to do. I mean, it was his money. And he has never told us how we should give it away or what we should do with it. He always tells me I can't hire more people. But other than that, well, see, then you figure out how to get consultants and all this other stuff. But, you know, there's always a way around it. But anyway, I mean, that's what he always says. He says, you know, just, you know, keep the numbers low and stay focused and keep the overhead down. So that's what we do. And, you know, the fact that he has never said to me, well, why did you do this or why aren't you doing that? We talk about what we do, but he's never said this is, you know, he's never given instruction as to what we should do.
All right, your foundation started with conservation.
Yeah.
And then you radically changed that. You know, what caused that to happen?
I was sitting at ADM in 1992, and a guy named Dennis Avery from the Hudson Institute was visiting, and I was arguing with him over conservation, and he was arguing over high-yield agriculture. And I was kind of taking this position that, you know, people should, respect how important certain environmental things are in the world. And he said to me, you know, how no one's going to starve to save a tree. And that one line changed everything for me, honestly. So the next trip I made to the Serengeti, I made it a point to ask if we could go talk to some of the people in a village that was close by to where we were staying. And I went there, and the people there were so used to tourists that it was actually frustrating. So we drove 3 hours the next day out to the village. And everything was in Swahili, so it had to be translated. But I learned that the cheetah that I'm over here helping fund a study on, and I'm taking pictures of and everything else, are actually a big problem for these people. And they would talk about how they would kill their livestock and how it would actually, at times, make it very difficult for them in terms of availability of food. And so I saw a different side, and I understood that if we don't, if people can't have choices in their life, then they're going to do whatever it takes to survive. So if I can't feed my kids, I'm going to, whether it's cutting down trees or slash and burn or whatever it is, that's what I'm going to do. And because I'm just worried about that day and that week. So I started to realize that you're not going to save cheetahs and mountain gorillas or elephants or anybody, you know, any other species if you don't save people first. And so it really changed my thinking.
How do the lessons learned in Nebraska and Illinois apply to your work on the continent of Africa or in other places around the world? You have a great quote in the book, that parachuting into a foreign situation with, you know, knowing your way is the right way and that your world ideal is the way to go, you're doomed for failure. But how have you translated what happens here in America to the other countries you've worked in?
Well, I'll start with a real simple example in terms of if you're a farmer in this country, you farm to sell what you produce. That's 95% of the farms. I mean, you have small gardening truck farms and things that are doing fresh vegetables, that kind of thing. But anybody around here, when you drive around and see big farms, they're selling what they produce. If you meet small farmers in Africa, Central America, wherever it is, those farmers are really there trying to survive, and they consume everything they produce and usually don't have anything to sell. And the other thing is, it's really odd to meet farmers who can't feed their own family. And so you're starting from a completely different point. And most of the world's like that. So whether it's health or education or, you know, agriculture, whatever it is. So the problem is we come out of a paradigm out of the Western world of what we expect. And so the first time I learned Well, I had some pretty good lessons. I mean, the first time I really learned a lot was when I went to Czechoslovakia when I was 14 by myself. And I got on the airplane, and I go through London, and I get off the airplane, and I got to get on a bus. And I'm thinking, well, I don't understand this. I always just go on the walkway, you know, and I'm in the terminal. And so I won't get on the bus because this guy's talking. I wish I could imitate an English guy, but I can't. But it was so heavy accented that I could not understand what he was saying. And so I wouldn't get on the bus because I didn't know where he's going to take me. And finally, this American says, "Kid, get on the bus or I'm going to drag you on the bus." And then I thought, okay, I understood that. So, you know, I got on the bus and went to the terminal. I figured it all out. But, you know, I landed, and first I thought, well, this is really cool because I'm landing and there's all these tanks and all these big things. You know, I mean, like a 14-year-old kid would think it was kind of cool. And then when I walked up to show my passport to this guy, you know, he's a big old mean-looking guy with a machine gun on his shoulder and not very friendly, and it just sunk in. I thought, whoa, you know, this guy didn't let me through, or this guy didn't like me. I'm not sure what's going to happen. Anyway, I got through, but I saw all sorts of things happen in that country that are very, very unfamiliar to me. And then, you know, later on, I had more experiences like that, and I just realized that it's so hard to think about things in terms of how other people have grown up and lived in a different way. I mean, we get pissed off when our hot water doesn't work in our house. You know, 3 or 4 billion people don't have water, clean water, you know, so it's let alone hot water. So, you know, we get used to something and we just make these assumptions. And so if you go into another part of the world with those same assumptions, you are going to fail because you're not understanding the culture. You're not understanding what their real issues are. The other time I learned it, I got arrested in Bosnia at the end of the conflict in 97, in February of 97. And I had no due process. I didn't get to make a phone call. But I was detained 3 hours. And the only reason why I got out of it the way I did was because I had a U.S. passport. And they just decided they didn't want a problem with a U.S. citizen right now. And they basically said, "You're going to leave the country. We're 100 miles from Croatia." And they said, "We're going to follow you to the border. You're going to leave the country." And we went to the border and left the country. But I mean, we just assume there's a rule of law. We assume that you're going to be treated fairly, that there's some kind of recourse if you're not treated fairly. Those things don't exist. And we spent a lot of time in Democratic Republic of Congo in the eastern part. And, you know, a mother there is not thinking about when her daughter's going to get raped, or if she's going to get raped, it's when she's going to get raped. I mean, it's a part of life. And you wake up in the morning, you don't know what's going to happen. You have no idea. You don't know if your kids can go to school. You don't know if you can feed them. So our whole paradigm of how our world works is so different than the rest of the world. And one of the biggest problems we make is thinking that because we think a certain way, that we have the solutions for people who live in such a different world in different circumstances.
The book is made up of 40 stories. You have to tell my favorite. And I want to know how you ended up making peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for a warlord.
Well, you laugh about it, but, you know, it was strange. I was actually finishing planting soybeans, and I got a phone call from Shannon Davis, and she said, "You need to get on an airplane tonight." And I said, "Well, I kind of need to finish planting, and I need to at least park my tractor somewhere where I have to worry about it." And she said, "Well, and bring sleeping bags." So I called Ann, who happened to arrive the day before, who was moving to Decatur from Seattle. And I said, "Ann, I know you're trying to buy a house, but we got to go to Africa tomorrow." And she was like, "Okay. And by the way, go to Kmart or what? I don't know, Walmart, whatever, and buy a couple sleep bags." So she did that. And we went off, and what had happened was Shannon, who had been working on Counter Lords Resistance Army Activity, the LRA, who's, you know, they're trying to catch Kony, who's been a pretty active about 26 years, and they were trying to catch him. Shannon had been very involved in that, and it was my first exposure to it a couple of years ago, and since then we've gotten pretty involved in it. But she says, "Look, there's a guy, General Cesar Chelan. He was captured, and he's a number 2 guy to Kony, and what they want is they want pictures of this guy smiling, looking good, because what's happening is when he would be caught like that, the rumors would be right away that they tortured him and killed him, and they wanted to make sure that people understood that wasn't true. So they put him on these flyers, and they dropped tens of hundreds of thousands of flyers across three different countries, and the flyers would have pictures, and the pictures were, most people were illiterate who would receive, so you couldn't write a lot, but you had to show them in pictures. And so they had on one side how you would give up, put your weapons down and give up, or even try to escape, and it would be that you would have amnesty, you would be okay. Well, nobody ever would believe that because they were getting told the other story in the camps. So my job was to get these pictures of Cesar Chelum. So we met that night with the Navy SEAL, who was the commander at that time. The U.S. has 100 military advisors in the area, which have actually been a huge help. And so I met with him, and the U.S. had not been allowed to meet with General Chelum yet, and so he's a little bristly about that. And I was asking his advice, and he basically said, "We'll never get this guy to smile." So I went to bed thinking, "How am I going to do this?" So in the morning, we got in a little caravan. We flew out to this undisclosed location in South Sudan, a little airstrip, dirt airstrip. And on the way out, I told Ann and Shannon and Dan, who were with me, I said, "I've come up with this strategy, and I think it's pretty good. I'm going to make this guy a peanut butter and jelly sandwich." And they just laughed at me like, "You're the biggest idiot." And I said, "Okay, what's your plan?" Well, they didn't have one, so they had to go with mine. So so we get there, and I always have this stuff with me. So I pull out this, a Skippy, extra chunky peanut butter, and grape jelly, the Welch's grape jelly. And then I had these really cool little, people always steal these from me. There are these real cool little Wonder Bread boxes where you put a sandwich in them and they say Wonder Bread, they're very cute. And so, and they always disappear. And I think Tony took a couple of them. But, anyway, so I get all this, I told him what I'm gonna do. So we get there, we have to talk to the colonel. Well, this is gonna be, I gotta tell you this part, this is kind of funny too. So the colonel, you gotta remember, we're sitting in the middle of nowhere on a dirt airstrip with attack helicopters around and a bunch of tents. And so we're under this other, the colonel's tent, and he's sitting down, and I know Shannon very well, but he looks at me and he says, "I know you." I said, "Colonel, I don't think so." He says, "Yes, I know you." I said, "Sir, I don't think so. I know you." And I'm trying to think, I really don't want to argue with the colonel in the middle of, you know, nowhere. And I said, "Well, I don't think so, sir." And he says, "Yes, I do." And he pushes this pad of paper and a pen across towards me, and he says, "Write your name down." So I write my name down, and I hand it back. "Yeah, I knew it. I know you." "There's no way you know me. You know, but I can't quite say it like that." And he says, "You're the rich guy from America." And I said, "Oh, you're thinking of my father." And he says, "No, I know you." And I said, "Well, I'm not really that rich. I think you're thinking of my father." And he says, "No." And I said, "Yes, it's my father. Colonel, it's my father." He says, and then after all of this, he says the funniest thing. He says, "Are you sure?" And I said, "Yes, I'm sure." And so anyway, so then the colonel brings out the general, and I meet him, and we go sit down. And I said, "Now, Colonel, I understand," because Shannon had told me for the four nights he'd been in the camp, they had fed him spaghetti. So I said, "General, I understand you really like this spaghetti and in the camp here." And he says, "What do you mean?" He speaks really good English. And I said, "Well, you know, the spaghetti." And so Shannon has to kind of interpret, said, "The noodles." "Oh, I love the noodles." And I said, "Well, what do you eat when you're in the jungle?" And he says, "I eat bark and I eat roots and I eat," you know, he says, it's like, "Oh, that's tasty." And so I said, "I know you like that, but that's, you know, that's an Italian cuisine." I said, "I came all the way from America to make something for you that Americans love." And I pull out my peanut butter, my jelly, and he's looking at me like, "You are a loco." And so I'm making a sandwich, and I cut it in half. And, you know, they poison people there all the time. So you know, I asked him which half he would like. He says, no, you go ahead and choose. And so he waits for me to take about two full bites, and then he eats the other half. And I said, do you like it? And he says, he looks at me kind of like he doesn't quite understand. And so Shannon asks him for me, and she says, is it good? And he goes, oh, it's tasty. Big smile. And Dan takes my camera, click, click, click. And he got the biggest smile of this guy that he's probably had in 22 years since he's been in the jungle. And so, you know, anyway, so we got the pictures. They put them on the flyer. There's a photograph of the flyer in the book. And they've dropped almost a million of them now.
That's amazing. That's absolutely amazing. I will remind you, if you haven't picked up your copy tonight, they still are available. Haynes and Essex are selling them in the back room. And everyone either brought a book tonight or buys a book tonight. On their way out, they're going to get a copy of the photo book to accompany this book. And it's amazing. I know you had a hard time with your photography getting in as much as you wanted to get into this.
Well, they made them all black and white in that book. So I went home and I thought, okay, I'll make my own book.
You can't buy them. And he did. You can't buy these. But as a gift from the foundation to you all for attending tonight, if you either brought a book with you or you buy a book tonight, just show them on the way out and they're going to give you a copy of this. One per person.
Somehow, I think if you don't even buy a book, you'll get one.
There you go again. you've been critical of agricultural policy in respect to subsidies in this country. Talk to us non-farmers about what should happen.
Well, for years we've had, I'll back up. We've had the most productive system in the world in most respects. And, you know, nobody in this room has had to worry about whether there's a grocery store close enough, or those shelves are gonna be full, and that there won't be like many, many, many choices. And so, you know, if you start from that point, you have to say we've been reasonably successful on our production. But we've also had farm policy that has encouraged certain behavior that I would try to change if I were like, you know, Secretary of Agriculture for the day instead of King for the day. And so I would say that, you know, we have done a lot of damage to our water quality. We've lost more soil since 1970 in this country than during the Dust Bowl years, and that's a fact. But you don't see it so much anymore because we've got great hybrids, we've got technology. And so, you know, if I have big ruts where I've lost soil, you'll lose it right out here on ground that looks flat to you. It's not so flat. It'll drift in the wintertime. I've driven down the interstate and seen white snow drifts that are black from the soil. And I can go out there and take a disc or field cultivator or whatever I take, and I can cover it all up and make it look pretty good and then plant it again. So there's no pressure and there's no incentive for us to protect our water quality and our soil. And so my concern is that, actually, the long-term concern is that we do enough damage that it begins to affect our productivity. But the short-term concern that farmers ought to have is if you look at the Chesapeake Bay, there's a 5 or 6 state area in that watershed, and they have highly regulated its daily load limits of phosphate, potash, nitrogen, and some other things. And it's much easier to point your finger at farmers than it is other, you know, point source pollution contributors. So farmers have all this regulation now in that basin, and my feeling is those regulators will be here one of these days. They're actually here now, but they haven't gotten as aggressive about it, and they will eventually. And so if you take our behavior as farmers, we can improve it considerably, and we've chosen not to do it because we don't need to do it. And that's true with almost anything. I mean, most people don't do something they don't want to do until they have to do something they don't want to do. And so our choice in the Midwest is going to be, do we have regulators tell us how we're going to change our farming methods, or tell us how they're going to modify certain things or measure certain things? Or as farmers, are we going to come up with the best ideas we can come up with that work for us that solve the problem? And so there's not enough urgency in the farm community about how we're going to deal with that when it happens. It will happen. I mean, there's no question about whether it happens in 5 years or 15 years. I don't know, but it'll happen.
We have some people here tonight that serve in Washington, some that want to serve in Washington. What are your thoughts about the SNAP program and proposed cuts to that?
Well, The problem with the SNAP program, when you talk about making cuts, is the easy way is you just cut it across the board. And so what happens is that you have a family of four, maybe. I read one story the other day where they were getting $539 in SNAP benefits in a month, drops down to a little over $400. It's a pretty big drop if you're, and this woman had a part-time job and her husband had just been laid off. So if you had a magical way of doing it, you know, you would take the 90 to 95% of the people in that program that want to work or are working part-time or whatever it is that can work, and you wouldn't cut anything. And you'd take the other 5% or whatever it is, of people who really don't want to make a commitment to solve their problem, and take the benefit away from them. But there's no easy way to do that. So you take the benefits away from everybody. We have 50 million food insecure people in this country today, up from 37 million maybe 5 or 6 years ago. You know, it's a clear reflection of the economy. I mean, the only way you're really gonna solve the problem is put people to work. But that's not anything we can do about. You know, we can't do anything about that at the foundation. So the issue with the SNAP program is that you're helping most people who need it, and some who really don't want to do anything to solve their problem or change their circumstances. And so cutting across the board, you hurt a lot of people. There's no program that's a federal government program that's at the scale that that program's at that's perfect. There's just no way. You can't do it. Okay, you can't administer a program like that perfectly. And you're going to have people to figure out how to cheat on certain things, or they won't tell the truth and all that. That's going to happen. But it's a pretty, pretty low percentage of people. And so, you know, I think that it's easy for everybody in this room. No one in this room put their child to bed hungry last night, and they're not going to do it tomorrow night. And nobody in this room probably cannot afford to go buy what they want to buy at a grocery store. So it's really easy for us to sit here and say, well, let's cut the SNAP program. You know, there's some lazy people on those rolls, and let's just get them off. It's very easy to do that. But if you're one of those people who relies on support or help right now, and you're trying to keep your kids in school, and you're trying to pay the utility bill, and you're trying to pay a mortgage or rent or whatever it is, it's not that easy. And so I think, you know, there are some places where you need to have some empathy about the fact that some people get away with a little bit, but for the majority of it, you're really doing something that's needed.
All right. You are famous for bringing people to town and taking them for rides in your combine. How does one get Eva Longoria, Shakira, former Prime Minister Tony Blair in a combine in Decatur, Illinois? How does that happen?
Well, the hardest part is it's in Decatur, Illinois. The easier was in Chicago or St. Louis. But I don't know. I just, you know, I know them. And I just invite them, and they come because they're intrigued. They've never been on a farm. They've never been in a combine.
But you let them drive the combine. I heard you upstairs say Tony Blair cost you quite a bit of money in a cornfield one afternoon.
He had a real hard time getting the corn head lined up in the corn rows. He ran it every time he turned around, he would run down corn. And I didn't invite him back.
Can you talk a little bit about your support for the local Decatur community and how you make decisions on what you support here? I've seen a lot of it firsthand. A lot of people don't get a chance because a lot of it's done very quietly. But I know you work with Sheriff Schneider and several people in the community, and you support a lot of projects here. How does that happen?
It's painful working with the sheriff.
I can't believe you'll even see him with him today.
Well, I thought it was Ben Affleck with that beard.
That's what I've been saying.
I'm ready to do another movie.
That's what I've been saying.
But there is no, he's running out of posts, so I think I can say this. This community is very lucky to have the sheriff.
Absolutely.
I gotta say that. I mean, he has been an incredible part of the community. You know, one thing you learn when you're not in a place like the United States is how important public service is, how important governance is, how important having honest people in government are, and that you can depend on them and rely on them to help solve the problem. So, you know, we're very fortunate that way in Decatur with some of the leadership we have. You know, there's no reason for us, there's two reasons why there's no reason for us to talk about what we do any place for the most part. Now, we have a little different strategy in Eastern Congo because we need people to understand we're making a commitment there, and we need the presidents of several countries there to know we're making a commitment. So we talk about what we do there. Most of the time we don't talk about what we do in Decatur, the areas around here, because there's no reason to do it. One is we're not looking for credit, and the other is kind of a selfish reason in a way, because we don't take unsolicited proposals, and so we really don't need a whole bunch of people coming. We get some anyway, but we don't need to. You know, we would rather discourage people from coming to the foundation saying, hey, why don't you do this? I mean, everybody has an idea they'd like to fund, or everybody's, you know, involved in something. I learned a long time ago, if we don't stay focused on what we do, which I have a hard time doing anyway sometimes, but, you know, if we don't stay focused, then, you know, we can't do as good a job as we need to do. So there's a lot of great people in Decatur and a lot of great organizations, and, you know, we support some of those, and we don't have a hard and fast rule on how we do it. We try to stick with things that are more consistent with what we do in the foundation, but sometimes you you know, you'll find something, or you'll learn about something, I guess, that is struggling, that's a great program. I mean, the one thing we don't like to do is give operating money, and the thing that we really don't like to do is give things year after year where people get it, kind of depend on getting it. I mean, we do a few little teeny things like that, like a Thanksgiving dinner at one of the schools or something like that. That, you know, they're
you were there today, right?
Yeah, and they'll either have it or they won't have it, and it's no big deal. And we just don't. I think it's a bad idea when people expect that they're going to get something on a regular basis.
I get that, but what school were you at today?
What's that?
What school were you at today?
I didn't get there today.
Okay, but every Thanksgiving.
I'm not going to tell you what school.
Okay.
There's actually two.
There's a couple of schools at an undisclosed location. Those kids, a lot of those kids maybe get the only Thanksgiving meal that they get the holiday season. And I know Kevin and I are always twisting your arm about being public, because I think, like your book, it does inspire other people to give. And it's not about credit. It's about telling everybody in this audience what they can do in their life to give back. And that, to me, was what the book was all about. And before we take some questions from the audience, I'll ask you about that. You want to put yourself out of business. In fact, you say anybody trying to solve big problems ought to be trying to put themselves out of business. Are you hopeful that that will take place?
Well, I know we're going to go out of business. Because we're going to, in 2006, before that actually, but we had set a deadline, but it'll be 40 years from 2006 when my dad gave us the first larger amount of money. And we'll be out of business 2045. December 31st, and that's like a line drawn in the sand for, and the trustees of our foundation know that, and that's going to happen. The point of that is, I'll take it at a kind of a micro level, the foundation level, and then a macro level. At our level, we have a great team of people. I mean, it's, you know, we it's amazing. You know, we have a great team of people that are committed to doing the best job we can do with the financial resources we have. And so why would we not take that team of people and have them apply all of our financial resources? They're applying all their intellect, all their effort, their total commitment. Why would we not? We have big problems today. Why would we not try to solve them now? And, you know, there are some foundations that will build big endowments. We can build a $1 billion endowment if that's what we wanted to do. But what's the point in that? Is that so that, you know, I can feel good because I've got this big endowment? Is it because I can have my grandkids give money away and I don't know if my grandkids will be good at it? I don't know if they'll be interested in it. I don't know if they'll do, you know, I mean, what are they going to give the money away to or for? I mean, so there's no incentive to me when I know I have great talent and I have financial resources and I know there's huge problems today. Why would I not try to solve them today? So that means I have to think that way. And if I'm going to think that way, it means I have to put an end to it. It means I have to be done at a certain point, and I have to be willing to do that. I will guarantee you, it makes a difference in the kind of urgency that you have. It can make a difference in the people that you hire. It can make a difference with the problems that you take on. And so, you know, we should be out of business in 40 years. In the macro sense, you know, if you take, I'm sure I'll offend someone here, but if you take public charities, NGOs, you know, whatever, I've never been at a fundraiser for one of them where they stand up and they say, here's my six biggest failures this year. They want to tell you their six biggest successes because they got to raise more money. They want you to write another check or a bigger check or more people write checks. So our system, our process, doesn't support the opportunity to easily go out and fail and to make mistakes. I make tons of mistakes all the time. But the important thing is hopefully I learned something from them. So, you know, if we have this process that tells people you just have to be successful, it's really hard to put yourself out of business in 40 years because you don't have that mindset. And you don't have that goal because I want to continue to be successful and I want to get bigger and I want to get better and I want more money to give away and all those things. So for me, I just feel like I have a limited amount of time to do what I'm trying to do, and why wouldn't I try to make the most of that time?
Kevin's going to be out there with a microphone, and we'll take some questions. If you have a question, raise your hand. I'll ask my final question. What do you hope people take away from this book when they're done reading?
Well, I think at different levels, but the first level is that everybody can do something. If you're physically able, you can do something. And the truth is, for most of us, I certainly speak for myself, and there's other people in this room that this would be true about, because I know a few of them sitting here, but some people make a real sacrifice in their life to help other people. I don't make a sacrifice. I mean, there's not much I have to worry about in my life. Well, there's nothing I have to worry about in my life, really. I mean, and so, you know, even if I go somewhere for 10 days and do something in a really tough spot, I get to come home. So, you know, the people who make personal sacrifices, and most people, and there'll be some of them sitting in this room, you know, they do it quietly, and it's their own business, and they do it. But everybody can help somebody in some way. And, you know, the other one is what I just talked about, which is urgency. I mean, you know, it's so easy to get complacent. It's very easy to feel like you don't want to try something that's kind of out of your comfort zone. And sometimes I talk to college students or something, and one of the first things I like to tell them is, get out of your comfort zone. You know, if you don't get out of your comfort zone, you're not going to learn anything. I suppose this is on tape, but I shouldn't say it, but you're not going to have one of those oh shit moments, you know, where, you know, you don't know what to do and you're scared and you like, you know, what's going to be the solution or how are you going to, you know, I mean, you need some of those because you just have to realize that life, you can't plan life out. You know, it doesn't work that way. I thought, you know, when I was 5 to 10, I was going to be a fireman. When I was 10 to 15, I was going to be a policeman. And then when I got to 16, I was going to be a lawyer. None of that worked, you know. And so it's really hard to plan life the way you think it's going to work. You always get some surprises. So, you know, you need some urgency and you need to be willing to take some risk. And, you know, you take risk within the ability you have to deal with what happens. What are the consequences of that risk? And some people can take bigger risks and some people, our foundation can take huge risks, and we do it all the time. We're building the largest infrastructure project in Eastern Congo in the middle of a current conflict with a number of armed groups. And I don't know whether it'll get built and get blown up or whether it'll get, I mean, I don't know. But we're building it, and we have good, I won't bore you with the reasons, but we have good reasons why we want to build that, and we want to build it now. And so, you know, we can take big risks. Not everybody can take big risks. So, you know, it's relative.
All right, let's take some questions from the audience. Don't be shy.
First of all, let me say thank you for writing this book, and thank you for your service and interest in feeding poor people. I was interested especially in the value-added system that you talk about in your book, and it seems like in some ways increasing production is the easiest part of the whole process. Would you explain a little bit more about how you create the value-added chain?
Yeah, I always kind of laugh when people say, well, we're going to go somewhere, we're going to create a market. And it's like, well, how do you create a market? Because usually a market creates itself.
Right.
And so we talk about how important the value chain is to really get people permanently out of poverty. But, I mean, I was in a refugee camp once in Chad, and they had hundreds of people coming in every night. And I'll never forget, you had the refugee camp here, and, you know, 100 feet over here, you had all these other tents set up, and You had people selling cell phones, you had people selling hair products, you had people selling, I mean, you know, it was amazing. And it was because all these people were coming in, and some of them still had money and brought money with them. And so here's, you know, it's this instant market. So market is always driven by demand, and that's the tricky part about your question, because the value, building a value chain is what really gets people out of poverty permanently. What you want to do is put people to work. Now, there's a huge part of people on the kind of the bottom pyramid, part of the pyramid, that's not going to work for. But we ended up starting focusing more in the center of the pyramid, where people were, with just a little bit of help, they could really make that jump. And so when you look at some of the programs we've done recently, they're all about, what's our exit strategy? Our exit strategy is, when we get done, people don't need us anymore. And you need an exit strategy, or you went to help people for a short period of time, and you left, and you went home, and you didn't solve the problem. And so you got to have an exit strategy. So our exit strategy has kind of become to work more with companies, to work a lot with the World Food Program, because they have a big demand on, and there's a chapter about the Purchase for Progress and how we do that with World Food Program in the book. But value chains, it all sounds like a great name, but the bottom line is, what you have to do is create the circumstances, or work on creating the circumstances, where people can begin to get what they need on their own. And so when you say the productivity is the easiest thing to increase, you're absolutely right. It's much easier, you know, if you can give hybrid seed or fertilizer to somebody and go, wow, look at the productivity. The problem is, we had a project in Liberia where it was going great for about a year with care, and then nobody showed up. None of the farmers showed up. We started trying to figure out what the problem was. The problem was, we weren't giving them anything. They had been given seed and fertilizer and other things for enough period of time that, because we weren't giving them anything, you know, they didn't want to deal with us. And we were trying to say, no, but if you're going to become self-sustaining, you need to, you know, we'll help you with loan, and we'll help you back up the loan, and we'll have, you know, there's all different ways of doing this. But in the end, we're going to go home in 3 years or 5 years. So you got to get along without us. And so, you know, it's the infrastructure, it's the credit, it's the training, it's the education. We have, you know, our P4P program. You know, you start talking to farmers, and they don't know what a contract is. They've never entered into a contract. Well, then you have to think about the mindset. Well, they can sign their name, but do they really understand that there's a commitment with the contract? And that's a big problem. And, you know, they don't understand quality. They don't understand delivery. So there's a lot to teach somebody who hasn't had the opportunity to be educated on those things in their lifetime. And so, you know, when we talk about the value chain, and my son wrote one of those articles in Afghanistan, or about Afghanistan, you know, what we're trying to do is find the weak links and try to figure out how do you support those, or link them back up with the rest of it, and then the whole system can work. But it's difficult to do, but if you can achieve it, it definitely solves a big part of the problem.
Okay. Can you talk about the Invest in Anchor program and how that started? I mean, because that's really starting to grow into a big deal.
Well, I stole the idea from Marv Baldwin, who runs Food Resources Bank. But He's got a group of farmers, a couple thousand farmers across the country, that he does this through their church network, and they set aside like a half an acre, 2 acres, you know, whatever it is, whatever they feel they can afford to do, and then he collects the revenue from that, and he sends it off to different projects they have in Central America and Africa. So I thought, well, why, if we have hungry people in this country, why can't we do that, and why can't we do it with farmers? And so we partnered with ADM, who was great, because they took the time to figure out what kind of process is it going to take, and how do you make it work with the elevator back and everything else. And Feeding America, who handles all the administrative part of it. And basically, a farmer can drive in, dump a semi-load of, there's a few farmers in here, I'd say 1,000 bushels, but that would be illegal, so I'll say 925. But you drop your load of soybeans or wheat or corn or whatever it is, and you just say, I want to put 50 bushels or 100 bushels or whatever it is towards Invest in Anchor, and that money goes back to their local community. So it gets converted from the grain to the cash to their food to their food bank in that area.
You've got some large partners with that too, right? Monsanto?
Yeah, Monsanto called up after we announced it and said we want to match you one-to-one, which is a huge boost. Now we're doing Invest in Acre Nebraska, because that was the easiest place for us to try to do it, and the Farm Credit Services are matching up to 100,000, 150,000 maybe, I can't remember now, one-to-one, and we have a lot of elevators getting involved. So we hope to kind of start building it state by state to make it a real national program.
Hi, you've traveled extensively to countries where farmers are obviously working in poor conditions. Have you noticed that fair trade policies have improved their conditions, or is it something that is continually abused by the people?
Translate.
Fair trade policies.
The what?
Fair trade.
Oh, fair trade.
Yeah. Fair trade is kind of interesting because I'm no expert on this, but we've kind of stayed away from it because there's politics involved in it. But what I've learned about it, is that you can define it different ways, and there's different organizations that will define it differently. So I think the concept is a great idea if you can really implement it and implement it in a fair way. The idea that you would try to equalize things for people who don't have the same opportunity and bring them into the marketplace by doing that is not a bad idea. And if you have people who are disadvantaged in the sense that they don't have the scale, they don't have the same access to markets or credit or certain things, trying to equalize that a bit against somebody like a Costco or a Starbucks, I think is a pretty good idea, but it's in the implementation that it gets difficult. And so I'm not an expert on it, and we've kind of stayed away from it just because every time we get close to it, there seems to be some different politics in it. We really don't want to get engaged in the politics of it. So that's not a very good answer, but it's all I can tell you.
Anyone else?
Yes.
Again, thank you for being such an inspiration to everyone here and around the world. Doesn't take long listening to you speak, reading your books, seeing your photography to tell that your travel has greatly influenced your perceptions and most likely your work and productivity. I've been to Kenya 5 times since 2007 volunteering and had many preconceived notions shattered, with our typical American expecting normal life, realize how different it is. And that experience has made a huge impact on my life, my perceptions. And I think that it's something only people that share that tribal experience can understand. My question for you is, how would you encourage more everyday people to trade in their week at the luxury beach resort to experience something a little further away from home, a little further outside their comfort zone?
Well, the only way I know how to really encourage it, and then this always comes back to haunt me with anybody who works for me, but is really, if anybody you work for, if you travel for business, because this is actually how I did it originally. I had a couple of opportunities that I could take my kids when I went on business. And so anybody who has a business that sends people anywhere in the world, if you can figure out a process in a way, let them take their, one of their children with them, that would be one way of doing it. And I would say, this isn't quite your question, but also businesses, and there's a lot of business owners here today, tonight, you can also encourage in a lot of different ways your staff or employees to get involved in the community by different incentive programs. And the problem at our place is that everybody's working so hard, they seem to never have time for it. But so I'm a little hypocritical when I say it, but I think it's a great idea if you can get it implemented in a business. And it's not always easy to do in a business because you're always thinking about the productivity of your employees. But that's one way to do it. I mean, I was able to take a couple of my kids at really young ages. I think Chelsea was 12 when I took her to Haiti, and Howie was 12 when I first went to Africa, or 13. And we don't go to Cancun and Paris, man. We places we go are usually not on your vacation list. And so, you know, you just, it's an amazing opportunity to see that even though people live differently, they look differently, they function differently in terms of their society, the truth is most people in the world want the same thing. You know, they don't want to worry every day they get out of bed, they have to worry about bullets flying. We don't worry about that. Unless Tony's practicing at the range.
Here we go.
I always pick on Tony. He was at Al Salvador. I got to tell the story. Al Salvador, is that where we were?
Yeah.
And he's sitting up front. Oh, maybe I shouldn't tell the story.
Oh, no, you have to.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I'm going to get in trouble with somebody. But besides you. But so we had this guy, Joe Winnie, who's like Mr. Chocolate. I mean, he's like, you know, runs his company in Seattle. And he came down there with us to try to buy cocoa. And so I was introducing Joe and what a great guy he is. And I got this governor on one side and like a vice minister of something on the other side. And so Tony's sitting in the front row, and I'm just thinking, I got to pick on him a little bit, you know. And so I introduced Joe, and then I say, and then I have Anthony Brown here. Tony Brown. Tony is the largest cocoa buyer in Africa. And he's down there. I won't do it because I'm on film, but he's giving all sorts of little sign language things that aren't friendly.
Yeah. And
the worst part is I stand up, and we start walking away, and the governor grabs my arm, and he says, that man is not from Africa. I totally busted. I thought, well, okay, I was just having a little fun. You know? Anyway, now I even forgot what the question was.
Okay, we got time for, what, one or two more?
Okay. Mr. Buffett, we have the Director of Agriculture of the State of Illinois, Bob Flagler, with us tonight. I'd like to ask a question.
You're going to give Bob the microphone?
Hi, Howard, and thank you for being here this evening. And I tell you, I just think it's you've been an inspiration in so many different ways. I had an opportunity to see your talk in Chicago with the Council of Global Affairs, and how you've, I think you told a story there about how you basically like to work locally on the farm and maybe go to the shed and meet with some farmers. And I've had, a video to send my way based on some of the techniques that you were talking about, the seminars that you put on. And I think that the folks who are farming in the local communities here, the small family farmers, really appreciate that and what you bring, because this is something that you've chosen to do. My question has to do with, how do you feel the family farmer will be doing here in the next 5-10 years relative to, you know, some of the efficiency gains that we're seeing? And do you think the family, what do you think it's going to take for the family farmer to continue to succeed?
Well, I'm pretty pessimistic about it. I think we've got a lot of things going on that don't work to help farmers that are, you know, 500 to 1,000 acres to stay in business. And I don't have great answers to this, but I think that it's to everybody's advantage to try to keep them in business. You see a lot of school consolidations. You see a shrinking tax base. If you want to talk about hunger, talk about rural hunger, where it's actually worse than urban hunger. Drive through a town like Tower Hill, where if you're living in Tower Hill and you don't have a car, your selection of what you want to eat is pizza and french fries at your Casey's. I mean, you know, so, you know, there's a lot of challenges in rural areas. And I think the more farmers we keep on the farm, the better off we are for a lot of reasons. The farming community is the first to respond. They're the most generous. You know, you have to be when you live in a rural area. You learn that your neighbors are not just your neighbors. They're the people you depend on when something happens, when something goes wrong. So I'm pretty pessimistic. I think that, that you know, if we could have, I'm going to sound like a Democrat rather than a Republican when I say this, but I mean, you know, we should think about what kind of policies keep people on the farm, and not so much about, you know, I mean, our biggest program today, which is billions of dollars, is crop insurance, which I believe in crop insurance in terms of the floor to make sure that farmers don't go broke. But last year, we learned exactly what that program could do, and it paid out more money to some farmers than if they'd had a decent crop. And that's not really what a safety net's designed to do. So I think, you know, having a little bit more efficiency in how we use our dollars in the farm program is one thing. But I think, you know, you look at a community like Decatur, it absolutely hurts when a Firestone closes up and that kind of thing. But it also hurts when you start losing the rural base and people start moving away. So I don't think there's a good answer for it. I think that the answer is that hopefully more people would care about it. Because, you know, a strong rural area is something that built this country. I mean, you go back to when this country started and 98% of the people were farmers. And there's an important heritage in it, but more than just the heritage, you know, we have a whole system built to support it. And as we lose that, or as that slowly erodes, I think it's unfortunate for the entire country.
All right, one final question.
Mr. Buffett, the mayor of Decatur, Mike McElroy.
Brother, I just, on behalf of the citizens of Decatur and the many causes that you help daily, I want to say thank you. It is certainly our privilege to have you live in our community. It's our privilege to watch what you do and learn from you. And I just want you to know you really are appreciated. And thank you very, very much. And, you know, the different organizations that you help every day couldn't make it without it. And because I think that a lot of people in this room are pretty well tapped out on what they've been trying to do, and to have a little bit extra come from you, that helps a lot. So thank you very, very much, and I look very forward to reading the book.
Thank you. You're on ahead. The reason you don't see me sit up here in a spot like this very often is because the truth is, I don't deserve any credit. I have the easiest job in the world. My dad made a lot of money. He decided to be generous and let his three kids have the privilege of helping other people, and it's really a privilege. And so there's nothing in my life that I sacrifice. My wife would tell you, Devin, who's here tonight, that maybe I neglect her a little bit. But, you know, there's nothing that we really sacrifice in our life to do what we do. So we don't really deserve any credit. I mean, so it's something that for me is not easy to hear, because I think people have to understand there's people sitting here tonight that have sacrificed way more than I'll ever have to sacrifice in my life. And so I think, you know, the key thing is that we can all do something. We all have limits. We can all volunteer. Some of us can write checks. But the truth is, the only way you keep a strong community is to have people that care about it. And I will tell you, I moved here in 1992. And this community is so much better off than it was in 1992. Staley was on strike, Firestone was on strike, Caterpillar was on strike. I think I was working at the only big company that wasn't on strike at ADM. And you know, I look back on those days and they were doom and gloom, and you know, a lot of people were hurting. And it isn't that today is perfect in Decatur, because it's never perfect anywhere. But the truth is, Decatur's a stronger community. There's a lot of great things. You know, we struggle to get people to move here sometimes. We've had somebody, Chad's here, he moved from Washington. We had Ann move from Seattle. We had Kelly coming from San Diego. We've had people move here. And the only way you get people to move here is by having a community that embraces other people, that is a community that wants to grow and do better. And so when you think about, you know, Decatur today, it may not be perfect, but the truth is, it's a lot better than when I moved here in 1992. And it's really because of people that are sitting in this audience and people that, that would never get here that are doing things for themselves. So, you know, I appreciate the fact that you say that. But the truth is, you know, Devin and I don't deserve any credit at all, because it's very easy to do what we do. So I'm going to close with one story about my wife, Devin. So, gosh, I haven't told this story for so long, I hope I remember. But I used to go, I ran for the county board when I was lived in Omaha, Nebraska. And so I would get up, I'd have to go to all these fundraisers. It was terrible. And, you know, and you have to act like you like it. And, you know, and I'm not as good at it as the sheriff. But, I would go to these fundraisers and you know, you'd have to stand up and say something. And so I'd stand up and I'd, you know, introduce them. I'd say, well, the mayor's here and city councilman so-and-so and the county board member and, you know, a state senator and all that stuff. And then I'd always, that was it. And I'd say something, you know, brilliant about taxes or something. And so I'd get done. And I always have people call me and go, you didn't introduce your wife. And I would like, oh God, they did it again. And I would do that over and over. You'd think I'd learn, right?
Right.
But anyway, I just want to say my wife, Devin, is here. And I'm not going to leave tonight without making the same mistake that I made for 4 years in the county board. And I would not be able to do half the things or two-thirds of the things without her. And she has four great kids that we drug back, well, not all of them, but most of them, back to Decatur when we moved here. And it was a great story because they were in Southern California. I moved them to Nebraska in the middle of the coldest winter they'd had in about 25 years. None of them would speak to me for a long time. And they all live in the Midwest now. And so, you know, I think that Decatur is a great community, and we're lucky to have the people we have. And can it be better? Of course it can be. It can always be better. But I think it's great that everybody came out, and I hope that we owe the United Way and the Young Philanthropy Group a lot of money.